There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I'm so glad that you can join me here for another conversation about some classic cardboard. And this week's podcast is not exactly classic cardboard. I call it more crossroads cardboard. And as the late, great Yogi Berra said, it's like deja vu all over again. Yes, we're going to revisit the dark days of 1994. Not that 1994 Tops, which are the packs I'm opening this week, not that 1994 Tops is a bad set or a bad thing or there's just no value in the set. There actually is. We'll discuss it a little later on. But it brings back some, oh, bad memories. 1994 baseball. And I've talked a lot about 90s nostalgia over the last several months. It is hard and heavy right now. You've got the people who were teenagers in the 90s, maybe a little younger, you know, maybe elementary school in the 90s, going through early adulthood, parenthood, having to, you know, work 40 hours a week at a minimum, pay the bills. Or maybe you're not working 40 hours a week. You're dealing with the unemployment crisis like the 20% or so, depending on which government official you agree with. Yeah, somewhere between 13 and 20% of this country is unemployed. Yeah, you know, maybe you're dealing with that difficult issue. And as I've said before, with nostalgia, and it is a rolling wave, you know, every generation tends to throw it back about 20 years just to feel good. You know, with nostalgia, you go back to that comfort food of happy days of your youth. And 90s nostalgia is big now. I think we've got maybe another year or two of 90s nostalgia, and then the next wave will come around. People will be pining for the early 2000s. And I'm not really sure if you really want to pine for the early 2000s, because that means more Nickelback on radio. And that's just something that this world cannot stand anymore. Pandemic, we'll get through it. Economic crisis, okay. World War III between China and India, well, as long as the missiles aren't pointed at me. But Nickelback, that's where I draw the line, bud. That's where I'm drawing the line. Can't do that. We've got to make a stand somewhere, and it starts with Nickelback. But anyways, you know, 90s nostalgia, it's still big now and will be for just a little while longer, I'm sure. And unfortunately, we're dealing with some 90s nostalgia these days that is heartbreaking. No, not those old Cleveland Cavaliers jerseys. No, I'm talking about the baseball labor strife. It sucks right now. And we'll talk a little bit about that because I do have some thoughts about the current situation. And really, the only common theme of the baseball labor unrest in 2020 compared to what happened in 1994 is that it's happening. And I really do believe that this is going to be a different outcome for both the owners and players that will not be good. And this, not the game, and that's something I'm going to differentiate later. The game of baseball is going to be just fine. But the Major League Baseball that we all know and love, or somewhat love, is going to be different. And maybe it has to be. Who knows? But we'll discuss that and also, like I said, the 1994 top set, why it's a big scab for me, not only just with the 94 strike, but also the end of the hobby for me for a long time. And I know for many of our collectors as well, that was a breaking point for a lot of people, just the mid-90s. And a lot of people, such as myself, just took a break from it for several years before getting sucked right back into it. So we'll discuss 94 Tops, which is an interesting set and does offer up some decent deals. And it could be a fun and quick and easy set for you to put together. It's not all that expensive to do it, save for one card. Yes, you know who, Jeets. Once again, Derek Jeter driving up the prices of junk wax from the mid-90s. So we'll dive into that in just a little bit. Before we do our usual house care and update you on everything that's happening with Wax Ecstatic, I do hope you are taking care of yourself and your family during the coronavirus. It is flaring up again. This is not unexpected. If you listen to the experts, and they normally don't have an R or a D next to their name, if you listen to the experts, they said that if you do this a little too quickly, if you don't take precautions, if you just kind of throw caution at the wind, then you're going to get a flare-up. And I'm living in Florida, and guess what? We're having a flare-up. A lot of states that were moving a little too quickly, in my opinion, to open things up or dealing with the side effects of the coronavirus right now. So no matter where you are, remember, keep washing your hands, stay safe, stay indoors if possible. If you are going to go out, wear your mask, all right? I know there's a lot of people going, well, you know, if I put a mask on, I'm having my rights infringed. You know, okay, that's debatable, but do you know what's worse than having your rights infringed? Being dead. Okay, that's the other option. So, you know, a little discomfort, heat and humidity, eyeglasses fogging up. Yeah, that's unfortunate. The other end of the spectrum, dead. So don't be dead, okay? Be smart. Wear the mask. Like I said, try to stay indoors, you know, in your home or your office. Don't get too close to too many people. Choose wisely if you have to go to a restaurant or a bar, okay? Just be smart. And, you know, don't be a selfish prick, okay? You're doing this not only for your health, but you're also doing it for the general population health. So don't be a selfish prick. Put on the mask, wash your hands, make some smart choices here, and together we'll all get through this, all right? That should actually be the national ad campaign for fighting coronavirus. Don't be a selfish prick. This message brought to you by the CDC. Or, you know, whatever group. All right, so that is my global pandemic soapbox. Please do take care of yourselves, okay? And we're not asking you to inject yourself with medicine every day. We're just asking you to wash your hands, wear a mask, take care of yourselves. And I know the vast majority of the public is actually doing that, which is a good sign. But one of the reasons why, you know, you're seeing these flare-ups and you're seeing these increased numbers across the country is because you got people who are just being selfish pricks, for a lack of a better term. Actually, that is a pretty good term now that I think of it. All right, so we're off the pandemic soapbox, and let's take a look at some of the tweets that we've received through our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter timeline, which is open 24/7. We always like to get pulled into some baseball conversations. And we had an interesting one that we were tagged in where a fan was actually keeping a campfire nice and warm by lighting up some old junk wax that is sitting in between the sticks here. It's Zach Byrne, one of our newest listeners, and he posted a picture of a couple logs smoking away. And if I zoom in on the picture here, I see an 89 tops Guillermo Hernandez, Greg Swindell, looks like a 93 tops Todd Worrell, 90 Donruss, John Smiley. Wow, John Smiley getting the campfire treatment here. And the funny thing is, Zach, you know, sent this picture and says, like caveman did. So it's a kind of a funny little joke there. But, you know, some listeners actually looked at it and it's like, wait a minute, you're still burning cards here. And Zach would like to, you know, throw in the caveat here. And I quote, I probably should have stated that these were already ruined cards by a younger me creasing or destroying them with fake signatures. Luckily, I only practiced on doubles. So for those of you who find some kind of sanctimony in junk wax, don't fear. Zach Byrne was very choosy when it came to the cards that he, you know, put into the campfire there. So Zach, thank you very much for sharing that picture with us and everybody sharing those thoughts as well. Also, we're still getting a lot of commentary about the rather 1990s dress code that was featured in the Bowman cards. And we were talking about the Bowman cards a couple weeks back, the 91, 92, and 93 era, which saw Bowman go from just kind of this afterthought brand into the brand that became the brand of the rookies, and it still is. But the downside of 1992 and 93 is that you had to look at the fashion designs. So that was the bad 90s nostalgia, you know, the awful baggy shirts and, you know, purple and teal and, you know, tropical colors. It was a strange time in the early 1990s. Audio Lux 7 sending us pictures of some 93 Bowman here. Or 92 Bowman, I should say. Manny Ramirez sporting the Guess jeans, green and white vertical stripe polo, or horizontal stripe polo. Of course, the Mariano Rivera card that we talked about, where he's got that teal golf shirt and the baggy khakis here. And another Manny Ramirez, so there was the gold Man Ram, and then there was the base set Man Ram, where he's looking all pensive and somber, still wearing the Guess jeans shirt. And yeah, everything is just a really bad Gap commercial when you look at a lot of these pictures, the casual pictures from the 1992 Bowman set. But it is a good reminder that not everything throwback is a good thing. I also got an interesting DM from one of our listeners, Brian Krause, who suggested doing a show on the 1960 Fleer set. And I said, you know, we discussed some of the early 60s, late 50s and early 60s Fleer sets when we did our first podcast on 1980 Tops. Now, this would have been probably about 2 years ago when we were finishing up the binder of classic cards. And a big storyline to the 1980 Tops story is the ongoing competition and then later lawsuits from Fleer, which in the summer of 1980 resulted in the Supreme Court case that opened up the doors for Fleer and later Donruss and all the other competitors to create cards to end the monopoly that Topps had. So I mentioned to Brian that even though we did touch up on some of those early 60s Fleer sets, it is something that I do want to revisit because since we did that discussion about those early Fleer sets, I too at various card shows have picked up a handful of odd cards here and there. I believe I have one from that 1960 set that you're talking about with you know, the Hall of Famers. You know, they were looking at past players and included Ted Williams. Of course, Williams had a very unique deal where he straddled the fence with marketing with both Fleer and Topps at the same time. I believe it was a Burley Grimes card. It was just one of those cards I picked up in a, you know, like 3-for-5 discount box, something like that. And it just looked interesting to me. It was something to add to the collection that I didn't already have. Also, I've added a few of the Ted Williams cards from 1959. And yeah, I do have a few of those early 60s. I think I've got a couple from the 63 set. And that was the set that Topps unleashed the lawyers on and put an ending to the 63 Fleer set. But that also, again, started the long, laborious, litigious journey between Topps and Fleer that would culminate with that U.S. Supreme Court decision back in 1980 that opened the door for the competition. So, yeah, I will be looking at some of the cards that I have, and I will see if I can track down some cards. It's a lot harder thanks to coronavirus. You know, the card shows that I used to go to, they're not being held locally, and I know there are some actually in the region that are on the calendar, but again, with the flare-ups locally, I don't know if I want to go to those. And I also don't know, you know, if they're going to happen. So my normal resource for some of those rarities, if you will, kind of going away at the time, but we'll see if we can track some down. So thank you very much, Brian, for reaching out. Now, as for upcoming shows, the next program that we will have will be coming up on July 4th weekend, and we will be taking a look at the Topps Mini UK cards from 1988. That's the set that I've got. And again, this is just an incredible set. I've known about it. I've heard about it. And perhaps once upon a time, I actually saw some of these cards, didn't really put much thought to it. But when I saw some of these on eBay and I was able to get a hold of them for a relatively cheap price, when they came in the mail, I was just blown away by how many these cards were. And this isn't just like, you know, looking at the 75 Topps minis or, you know, some of the other mini sets that were created in the early 90s. You know, Topps made a couple of mini sets. Bazooka had a mini set as well, or like a little subset that was included in boxes of their bubblegum. And I just didn't recall actually seeing the Topps UK cards. And it was just amazing, not only because of how many they were, but how incredibly unique they were. And also, you know, how they tried to grow the game overseas. And it's a very simplistic set, loaded with stars, pretty nice design too. And like I said, affordable. You know, this is, I don't want to call it a rarity because there's certainly plenty of them out there floating around. But if you want to find a unique set of baseball cards from the junk wax era that is not produced at junk wax, numbers, then we can certainly discuss this set here at an affordable price. You can get them for, you know, $8, $10, $12, depending on where you buy them. So looking forward to that show. Again, that will be our next program 2 weeks from now on July 4th weekend. Also, some upcoming attractions here. We will be talking to Brad Blukjan in an upcoming show. I don't know if it'll be the show after the Topps UK Minis, but it will be sometime relatively soon. Brad Blukjan, of course, the author of The Wax Pack, a book that took a very, very long time for him to not only write, but more importantly, get published. And Brad, rightly so, is taking a victory lap, especially on social media. You can follow him at Waxpack Book, that is the Twitter handle. And rightly so, he is bragging about the success of the book. He was turned down time and time and time again when he was pitching this project to major publishers, finally got a break with the University of Nebraska Publishing Unit. And the Waxpack Book is doing extremely well. I'm actually reading it right now. I've only gotten about 4 or 5 chapters in, but I am thoroughly enjoying it. So even before we get Brad on the program, and even before we talk about some of the particulars of the book, I highly recommend any sports fan, but really any card collector, get the Wax Pack from Brad Blukjan. It is available now, and you can't miss it because the book jacket is designed like a wax wrapper for the 1986 Topps set. And there's also an interesting feature of the Wax Pack book. And I've got to ask Brad about this because I'm sure it was intentional. If not, it's a happy accident. But the texture of the book cover, the book jacket, has this kind of thick, waxy feel to it. So either this was a nice, subtle ode to the old wax packs that we used to open up, or the University of Nebraska printing press has a little issue with it. But either way, every time I'm picking up that book, I'm getting that kind of thick, waxy feeling when I touch the book jacket. And it is a nice, subtle, subliminal nod to the old wax packs. But it is an outstanding book. I'm enjoying what I've read so far. Looking forward to completing it probably within the next week or so. And we'll talk to Brad about it. Now, Brad was a guest of ours many, many moons ago. If you look through our archives, you can find the show. I believe it's episode, I want to say 29. I may be off there. But go back to the shows from 2017. You will find our conversation with Brad Blukjan after our first podcast highlighting 86 Topps. And it was just great timing, since we were talking about 86 Topps, to have a show dedicated to the Wax Pack book. And I'm looking forward to talking to Brad, not just about some of the stories from the book, but also the story about the book. Because when we did that interview 3 years ago, he was done researching it. He had pretty much written the story, and he was in the process of shopping it around. And as I said, it took almost 3 years from the time that we had that conversation to find a publisher, get it printed, and he is doing remarkably well. And again, if you read the stories, you're going to see why. Now, if you are a fan of the player bios that I do on this podcast, and I know quite a few of our listeners, that's the favorite part of the program near the end of the show when we take a look at typically 4 players that we pull from the packs, you will really enjoy the Wax Pack because some of the player stories, and that's a key part of the whole book, you know, following up on the quote-unquote common card players from this pack of 1986 Topps Baseball. Just some of the stories are really enlightening, and some of them are sad, some of them will make you think, and some of them are inspirational too. And it's a big backstory to this whole podcast as well, and I owe a debt of gratitude to the late Larry Cox, the utility catcher For the Seattle Mariners in the early 1980s, he was the first player that we did a show on. And what I was first going to do was, you know, kind of make fun of Larry Cox. And then I, you know, looked through the biography and, you know, saw the unique story of him as a ball player, the tragic ending, you know, having a heart attack when he was playing basketball with his son. And he was a loved coach for the Chicago Cubs at the time that he died. You know, that changed the course of the direction for the podcast forever. So, you know, when you get to dive into the stories of some of these players and get to understand a little more where they come from and what they've been doing recently, you have a whole new respect for the common card, as the case may be, or as Brad puts in his book, the underdog player. So we're going to talk to Brad at some point in time. Also, I'm working on 75 tops. I'm trying to secure an unopened pack of 75 tops, the regular packs, not the mini packs. And a reason why is because I recently had a listener send me a card donation. It was a rather hefty card donation. While I'm always appreciative of card donations, I received about 3,000 cards from this listener. So thank you. But also at the same time, you know, if you're going to send me a card donation, please, you know, let's limit what's being sent, because my wife gets heart palpitations to begin with, and she doesn't need any more with a big box of cards showing up. So, you know, that's something that we can work out if you want to send a large lot of cards as a donation to the program. But, you know, we do need to kind of take it on a case-by-case basis. But part of this donation was a healthy serving of 75 Topps baseball cards. No star cards, but, you know, a pretty good assortment. I'd say probably about 300 or 400 cards. Quite a few dupes, and that's just part of the double printing bugaboo of 1970s Topps cards. And there were enough cards to where I said, you know, maybe I'll just start hand collating this set. So once again, I have another set and another checklist, and probably about 250, 300 cards here with this set. But it did inspire me as I was putting together that checklist. I thought, you know, maybe we should revisit 75 Topps, much like we did 74 Topps a few months ago. So I'm trying to track down an unopened pack of 75 Topps. They are not cheap. And give me some time. I will eventually get one. I do have a pack in my own personal collection. It's just sitting in a plastic storage box, and you know, it's part of my 70s pack collection, but I don't want to open that one yet. That's I don't know when I'm going to open the one that I have, but I will eventually find a good deal on a 75 Topps pack, and I think we'll do a show on 75 Topps. And last but not least, we're going to do that mystery pack. Boy, I had a lot of guesses. A lot of you were guessing about the set that I said I teased you a lot about. I said that it was a set that was mass-produced. It was not exactly popular back when it was produced. It is certainly not popular now. It's kind of laughed at. And it's really not popular just because of the mass production and some of the, let's say, cross-promotion. That'll give you a big hint. And, you know, there's not a big monetary value to this pack, even though it is borderlining on vintage status these days, and even though it features quite a few Hall of Famers, it's still not a popular set. And I'm still going to tease you. I'm not going to tell you what it is yet. I've had a whole assortment of guesses from listeners, and someone came very close. Didn't quite hit the nail on the head, but somebody came very close with a guess. So I'm going to keep teasing for a couple more weeks. I'll tell you what that set is in our next show when we're talking about the Topps UK mini set. Because this particular set is affordable, relatively easy to get. Like I said, loaded with Hall of Famers. It's just mass produced. It's just not popular, and a lot of people look down at it. But it does definitely fall into the bucket of unique miscellanea. And it's something that I found while organizing my cards a few weeks back. I have the set. I thought, oh, this will be interesting. And it is a set that is an educational piece. It's actually a very worthy of, you know, historical footnotes. It's a worthy set. I wouldn't try to sell it. I wouldn't try to make a ton of money off of it, but I do see some of the value of it as a youngster looking at these particular cards and learning about some of the baseball greats of past time. And that was something that was not easy to do pre-internet days. And, you know, I was looking at these cards in, you know, the late 80s, early 90s. They were actually produced in the early 80s. That's one more tease. I'm sure somebody will figure it out. But I will tell you what that topic will be. I don't know when we'll do that show. Again, it's kind of an oddball set. Don't want to focus too much on the oddball sets. But it is something that we will discuss sometime within the next 2 or 3 months. I can guarantee you that. Last thing in our housekeeping department, as always, donations are welcome here at Wax Ecstatic. Again, card donations, if you have specific cards that you would like to talk about on the program or sets, and you have extra packs or you have dupes that you want to share, go ahead and DM me or email me, mattsammonsays, that's S-E-Z at gmail.com. And, you know, like I said, let's arrange an appropriate trade here. I welcome all donations, but I just don't, you know, unless they're all 75 tops. having a 3,000 card donation is a little overwhelming. So, you know, we do want to come up with a good trade here. But also, if you have a little extra change, and I know times are tough for a lot of people, but if you would like to make a cash donation, you are more than welcome to at paypal.me/waxecstatic. And Wax Ecstatic is one word, paypal.me/waxecstatic. Even just a few bucks here or there goes a long way in paying Audio Boom, our home base, to host this podcast, to keep the archives free and available for anyone to listen to and download. Also, it helps us purchase the products that we discuss on this program. And as always, we go the extra mile with some of the extra products. Some of those 75 Topps cards will be going to Commons for Kids, great group of people that collect common baseball cards, and not just baseball, all sports, and they will assemble these cards in nice little care packages for kids who are having a tough time in life. Maybe they don't have the money to buy baseball cards. We know they're not cheap these days. Maybe they are just in a bad situation. They're in a bad home situation, bad economic situation, or in many cases, they're dealing with medical issues, serious medical issues. They're hospitalized. They're going through, you know, cancer treatments, stuff like that. What is better than just a little bit of happiness of looking at pictures of your favorite baseball team or baseball players? That's what Commons for Kids does. So we are always happy to take even the leftovers from large cardboard donations. We will box them up, send them out to Commons for Kids, and help them keep their cause going strong. So many ways to help out the program. And in helping out the program, we help entertain you. We certainly appreciate everyone who, in one form or fashion, be it a cardboard donation or a cash donation, keeping this program going strong. All right, let's talk about the set that we are focusing on this podcast. It is 94 Topps, a set that is relatively affordable, relatively easy to get. Again, a Derek Jeter card is kind of gumming up the works, but in a good sense, it makes 94 Topps at least something worth chasing down, as opposed to, you know, the 91 Fleer set that you can buy packs and boxes and complete sets for only a handful of dollars here and there. So, you know, there is still a little bit of a chase factor to 94 Topps. But as we'll get into in just a moment, there's a lot of downsides too, where Topps tried to go a little overboard on some special types of cards, and it really just kind of brought the whole set down. So once again, Derek Jeter saving the day with some junk wax era baseball cards. But when you look back at 1994, that was a big year for me and a big year for a lot of baseball fans and also card collectors. You know, if you were a baseball card collecting baseball fan in 1994, life was not easy. And for me, it wasn't easy because I had this perfect storm of, I don't want to say setbacks, just kind of letdowns. And of course, the baseball strike that came around in 1994 and the later cancellation of the World Series, that was a big part. Also, I was a huge hockey fan. I still am. But, you know, there was a player strike or a lockout. I forget what the correct terminology is. I think it was a lockout in 1994. That delayed the start of that season until January 1995. And then, of course, as a card collector, the industry was just getting too big. It was ballooning too quickly. The base sets were all kind of second status. Everything was a premium set. Everything had a gold foil attachment to it. Everything had, an insert. Eventually, the world of refractors and different variations would come booming out, in the mid to late 90s. And it was harder and harder as a kid, even though I was making some decent money, mowing the neighbor's yard. Also, I had started working as an instructor at a summer camp the previous summer. I had some dollars in my pocket. But even though I was, a fairly productive 16-year-old kid, it was hard to justify spending more and more money on baseball cards as the packs got more and more expensive. You got fewer and fewer cards. And even though some of the cards, if you were lucky to pull one of those special black gold cards, or you were able to get that key rookie card, the value of the card would be higher and you could flip it real quickly for, some cash or maybe a nice trade for some, storage products or whatever. It was still, a tough choice to make. Okay, do I spend the extra $2 or $3 on a pack of baseball cards, or do I put it elsewhere? And as I've discussed before, when you're 16, you're often putting your money elsewhere. The two main things are your car and your girlfriends. And in 1994, I was chasing both, trying to, land any kind of date with any girl in high school. And I was not exactly the most popular kid on campus. How do you like me now? No, but it's teenage angst. You're just, let's be honest, you're trying to get a lay. And, on top of that, you're also trying to get wheels. It's around 16 that many states you can get your driver's license or your learner's permit. So, I got my learner's permit. I was able to drive. I was the receiver of my dad's old 86 Plymouth Horizon, which was basically a pregnant roller skate. That's what it looked like. It was a very dependable car. My dad put probably 125,000 miles on it, probably smoked 125,000 cigarettes in the car too. So that was lovely, trying to get that stench and those stains out of that car. But, I was working on that. All right. How do I get the car? How do I keep it running? It was barely running by then. Didn't have a horn. Somehow the horn broke. We never repaired it. And I actually failed a driver's test because I didn't have a working horn. So that, talk about a letdown. Like, you fail a driver's test before you start it because you can't show the instructor that you can honk the horn. So it was a very emotional time. And to have the baseball strike happening at the same time really put a dark cloud over my view of sports and some of those fun outlets that I had access to when I was, a little younger. And you know what? When you took baseball away and you took hockey away and, baseball cards were harder to collect and I just didn't have the passion to open up these cards, it opens the doors to other recreational events. And fortunately, I was a pretty good kid. But I'll be honest, starting around 16, 17 years old, I started drinking alcohol. Nothing wrong with that, in the sense that, a lot of kids do that. But, I drank a lot of alcohol, especially in college too, and for a few years after. And hey, I still enjoy a beer or a scotch or a whiskey, but, certainly in moderation. I mean, I'm 42, I'm not 22. There's just some things I can't do anymore. But, my point is that when you're able to pull away or you're forced to pull away from some of these outlets of entertainment, such as watching a baseball game or cheering a team or collecting the cards of your favorite players, it opens the door for other options, some of them healthy, some of them not so healthy. So again, fortunately, I was mostly healthy in some of the decisions that I made. Fortunately, by the grace of God, I didn't get myself killed. I probably could have a couple of times along the way. And it all goes back to that baseball strike. And it was just such a bitter taste in my mouth. And when they went on strike, it was August 12th. When they went on strike, I was pretty dour about it. I remember I was on summer vacation, staying at a hotel. My family would stay at a hotel on the beach for a week. And it just happened to be during that week that everything was put on hold. And there were a couple of regulars at this hotel. There was a family down from Chicago. There was a family down from Toronto. And, you know, we happened to stay at that same hotel that same week for 2 or 3 years at that point in time. And we were all just commiserating how much it sucked. You know, me and the family from Toronto, we were obviously Blue Jay followers. The family from Chicago, they were Cubs fans. And we were all very unhappy. And nothing brings down summer vacation on the beach like being dour about a baseball strike. And then, of course, it was, about 6 weeks later, Bud Selig canceled the World Series. You had the, attempt by Major League Baseball to put the replacement players through, which got struck down by the courts and forced the season to start a little late in 1995. And even though baseball was back, I held a grudge and I just went, screw you. You know, I'm not just going to come running back to you. And sure enough, I didn't. The only game that I watched on television was Cal Ripken's 2,131st consecutive game, because that broke the consecutive streak of Lou Gehrig. And that was something that I had followed a lot through my fandom in baseball. So I felt it was almost like obligated. It's like, no, I really need to watch this game. So I did watch that in September of 1995. But after that, I just had no desire to watch Major League Baseball. None. Zip. Zilch. Zero. That would change a couple of years later when I was actually able to attend my first Major League Baseball game. It was out of combating boredom. My grandmother had passed away. She lived in Brooklyn. And, you know, my family went up there for the funeral. And after the funeral and burial, we were still up in New York City for 2 or 3 days. And, you know, we were just looking for something to do. And I look at the schedules of the baseball teams. The Yankees were out of town. The Mets were in town. So I was able to talk my dad into taking us to Shea Stadium, and we went to see the Mets and the Braves. I don't recall the exact date of the game. It would have been late July of 1997. I recall that Carlos Baerga hit a game-winning home run, or what would prove to be the game-winning home run late in the game, like seventh or eighth inning. And always having some bit of animosity to the Braves, even though I didn't really care for the Mets. I kind of became a Mets fan that day because it was always fun to beat the Braves. So, you know, we enjoyed the lavish surroundings of that semicircular dump known as Shea Stadium. We got to get up close and personal with every Boeing 737 that flew over the stadium, landing at LaGuardia Airport. And that was my first rekindling getting into baseball. And eventually, long story short, you know, got caught up in the home run chase in 98, moved back to Tampa in 99, became a Rays fan, and the rest, as they say, is history. But, you know, that strike in 1994, that was very hard for me to really love baseball again. And, you know, it was fun to follow a team again when I moved back to Florida, but I didn't really love baseball again until I had a son and, you know, I started introducing him to baseball cards, and he's such a sports fanatic. You know, he would watch, you know, hockey and baseball and football. He plays Little League. So, you know, I have a love for the game of baseball again, and something that I didn't really have, you know, 25 years ago when the game was on hold. So, you know, 1994 just really stuck with me. And that was also, again, one reason why I had such a long break between collecting cards. You know, I did not buy any new baseball card after 1994. I bought a couple packs of Topps in 94, just had no desire, no interest. And again, all the disposable income, it was going elsewhere. It was hanging out with friends. It was trying to get my car working. It was, the hopeless pursuit of a hot date. And, you know, it wasn't going to, you know, cards of Gary DeSarcina. Just wasn't going in that direction. No offense to Gary DeSarcina, but, you know, I was chasing more attractive things. So, you know, 1994, even all these years later, there's just a little chip on my shoulder about that year. So, you know, first of all, a tangent here about what's going on in 2020, okay? I don't think it matters if you side with the players or you side with the owners. And if any of you follow my personal account on Twitter, Salmon Says, S-E-Z, I commented on this a few days ago. And I think a lot of people are in agreement with this general thought. when you look at what's going on in the world right now, and you look at the coronavirus, and you look at record unemployment, and just economic collapse, we're still teetering. And not just, you know, locally, this is worldwide. There's a huge ripple effect here. You've got the Black Lives Matter protests. You've got race riots countering those. You've got just everyone is just up in arms. And of course, you're already getting the comparisons to like 1968 and other, you know, rough years in the past. But you just look at everything that's going on. And where baseball and their labor strife, where it fits in the grand scheme of things, it ain't near the top. And that is going to create an incredible audience of apathy to where both the owners and the players, and again, I don't care which side you choose, or even if you don't choose a side, I don't personally. I'm old enough and wise enough to realize I can't really link up with either side here because they'll both hurt your feelings, all right? But the owners and the players are going to discover very quickly. They may not admit it. They may not react to it, but they're going to see it. That given all the other crap that is going on in this world today, nobody cares about your problems. Baseball owners, you're trying to make more money. Nobody cares. Baseball players, you're trying to keep your money, trying to stay healthy. Nobody cares. Guess what? I'm trying to stay healthy. I'm trying to keep my money. I'm not trying to, you know, default on any loans or, you know, I'm trying to make my mortgage payments, you know, and by the way, I'm doing fine. But, you know, there are a lot of people struggling, and it's at a different level in a different world than the quote unquote struggles of people who are making more. Now, I know that there are a lot of players that aren't multimillion players. I know that the whole minor league system is backlogged because they haven't been able to have a season two. But this hijacking, this attempt to take the coronavirus situation and turn it into a power play and a money-saving, money-grabbing issue is something that the average fan does not care about, does not relate to, and will not put an ounce of emotion into. So I think the biggest difference between 2020 and 1994 is that people just will not care. In 94, I remember you took sides. Either, you know, the owners were these greedy bastards and trying to keep the man down and, you know, trying to repress player salary growth. And that's something that, you know, you saw throughout the 80s with the collusion. Okay. And hey, you've seen it in the last few years too, where especially, you know, free agent pitchers, magically there were no contract offers happening. There was a lot of questions about that. So, you know, maybe you sided with the players or you sided with the owners. Yeah, they're rich guys who own these teams, but those players, they're big babies. They used to play for the love of the game. All right, it was kind of indentured servitude in many factors, you know, before the free agency came around widespread in the late 70s. But, you know, the reserve clause did that. And, you know, you could pick a side, you could argue about it. And when the strike ended and the season started up in 1995, you could either claim victory or, you know, be upset about defeat. But it was different. The economy was on an upswing in the mid-90s. There was no global pandemic. Unemployment was coming down. People were feeling more optimistic about the future. There was a recent study that said Americans are at their most unhappiest in 50 years. That's including the Nixon and Carter administration, folks. Okay, we're kind of unhappy. You know, that's also including the recession of 2008, the 9/11 terrorist attacks. We're pretty damn sad right now. So the plight, quote unquote, tongue in cheek, of baseball owners or baseball players, nobody gives a rat's ass. I'm too busy trying to take care of myself and my family. You guys keep fighting. You know what? I don't care. And that is the danger to Major League Baseball. And as I said on my Twitter feed, if there's one thing that I've learned, and it's especially about sports, but if there's one thing I've learned working for a sports team and working in sports media for many, many years, the only thing worse than fans complaining is fans not caring. And Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association and associated groups, broadcast outlets, media companies, advertisers, merchandise salespeople, and baseball card producers, we're all going to see very quickly that given everything else going on in this world, nobody cares. And that's going to be the biggest challenge for Major League Baseball coming out of this. However it works out, and it will eventually, but no matter how this works out, first of all, you've got a generation, my generation, that was burned from 1994. I'm not exactly clamoring to come back to your games. But you also have a whole new generation, people in their 20s and 30s, for the first time experiencing the hardships that this world is doling out right now, who just cannot invest the emotional outcry that we could have 26 years ago when this first happened. So you're going to have a double barrel whammy of generations, all aged 50 and under, it's kind of a huge chunk, guys, who just don't care. And that's going to be the toughest part for Major League Baseball. Now, the game of baseball is going to be just fine. And this is something that I learned, or I heard back in 2012. I was working for the Tampa Bay Lightning. There was a, what's the correct legal term? Work stoppage. That's what the league told us to say. There was a work stoppage, and, you know, it was hard. This was the first sports work stoppage in the social media age. You were seeing live reaction to news, and it was often bad before they worked things out in January of 2013. And there was a great line from John Buchegrass of ESPN. And Buch has a following. Buch can be a pain in the ass too. But he had a great line. Love the game, don't love the league. I was going to say love the sport. But he said, love the game, don't love the league. And that was very revealing to me. For those of us that were dealing with that nonsense back in 2012, love the game of hockey, but you don't have to love the NHL. And that's how I see this whole baseball strife right now. Love the game of baseball, but don't love Major League Baseball. And I can live with that. Hey, I'll go coach my son's little league team again. Absolutely. I'll go to a minor league game once the minor leagues get things sorted out. You know, I'll, you know, assist kids who want to grow up and play the game that they enjoy. And, you know, kids are so resilient. They may not have the same chip on their shoulder about Major League Baseball like adults do. But I still love the game. The game is great. The game is, I don't want to say pure, but it's a wonderful thing. And I love the game. But Major League Baseball and the MLBPA and all associated people with it, you're going to discover this time is different. People don't care. And you're going to lose some people for good, and it's going to be completely different. So that is my other soapbox I'm standing on now, the strike issue, which takes us back to 1994 and this top set. It is actually an outstanding top set. It's a good design. It's simple with a little touch of flash. It is not something that was very progressive in 1994, like it wasn't full front card photography like you saw certainly with Upper Deck at this point in time, and you would see with, like, you know, Donruss Elite or Fleer Ultra or Top Stadium Club for that matter. But even though there's a little bit of white border, even though there's a little bit of kind of a kaleidoscope effect where the player's name is, it's still for the most part a clean look. Backs of cards are nice and clean too. Full color action photos, complete stats for a player as well. If room permitted, some kind of information, a little bio note here or there. Not quite the fun cartoons of the 70s, but keeping with the times, this was kind of the standard card back. The downside to a lot of the 94 Topps cards is the UV coating, much like a lot of cards that had UV coating, you know, early to mid-90s. All these years later, these cards, you know, sitting in these packs in warehouses, they stick together, and there was some UV coating damage to some of the cards that I opened up in our video, which, by the way, I forgot to mention that. If you haven't watched the break yet, just go to YouTube, type in Wax Ecstatic 1994 Topps Wax Break, and you'll see that. Fortunately, the damage wasn't on a lot of cards, but you could see it, and you can hear it, that cracking of the UV. It's so annoying, and you're peeling cards off one another. It sucks. But that's one of the downsides, too. That UV coating was just a real bear all these years later. The other big problem, too, with the Topps cards is Topps tried to do just a little too much. They were putting in the Topps gold cards, the black gold cards. They were also inserting some Topps Finest cards. That was another new product that they were trying to promote. But they also just went overboard on some of the rookie cards. Got a little redundant with some top prospects, including Derek Jeter. So after the Jeter draft pick card of 1993 did generate some buzz, and granted, you know, Jeter wouldn't play in the big leagues until, what, 95. And, you know, even though he was a highly touted prospect, you look back at Jeter's minor league numbers, especially his defensive numbers, he still had a lot of work to do. So there was a lot of faith behind Jeter back then. But even after the Jeter draft pick card in 93, Topps put him as one of the four faces on a top prospects card. So that is in Series 1. That is why Series 1 is a little more pricier than Series 2 if you're buying packs or boxes. Still pretty affordable. I've seen some boxes of Series 1 going for, you know, anywhere between $35 and $50. So certainly not a 91 Donruss Series 1 box, a little pricier, but overall still a decent find. Series 2 is a lot easier to find, and I've got the Series 2 packs here that we opened up. And the other issue is, other than, you know, trying to double dip on the Jeter hysteria at the time, Topps was starting to stick its neck out with some prospects. Now, even though Bowman was becoming the brand of the rookie card or the prospect card, you know, players who wouldn't see the light of the major leagues for several years, Topps really stuck its neck out too on some of these players. And while you hit a home run with a guy like Derek Jeter, there's some other guys, not so much. A couple of cases from the cards that I pulled. David Cooper, not to be confused with the current first baseman David Cooper, who's played with the Mets and the Blue Jays. Very inspirational story, too, how he was nearly paralyzed several years ago, but now he's playing big league ball. No, this was a pitcher named David Cooper who was with the Mariners, and I pulled that card, and we look at draft pick David Cooper. David Cooper never made it past low A in his career. And I know what you're thinking. You're like, well, Matt, you know, sometimes that happens with some prospects. Well, another prospect card that we pull, Josu Estrada, draft pick of the Expos. Same thing, never made it past A ball. And, you know, when I say never made it past A ball or low A, in both of these players' cases, I'm talking about guys who played 2 or 3 years in the minor leagues, and that was it. So even though you hit that home run with the Derek Jeter card, a lot of these other prospect cards are not only busts, but complete washouts and kind of a waste of the set. 792 card set, you've got to have two or three big names. And while a lot of people were chasing rookie cards in the early 90s, thanks to Derek Jeter, but also Manny Ramirez. Of course, you had the David Justice sweepstakes back in the early 90s. Kevin Moss, remember that guy? You know, all these other names, and you had some bona fide stars like Frank Thomas and Ken Griffey Jr. coming around at the same time. You know, people were chasing rookie cards all the time, and it just seems like Topps was starting to just throw some darts. You know, all right, let's try this one. All right, David Cooper, let's put him in the set. Okay, let's put this guy in as well. So you have a lot of incredible duds when it comes to the rookie cards or the prospect cards in 1994. So that's another downside, too. With that said, I like the overall design of 94 Topps. It is affordable. At 792 cards, it was not at a 900 card series. It was actually smaller than the 93 set. And, you know, you weren't chasing 900 cards and their variations like some other sets were at the time. So it's relatively easy to put together. It's relatively inexpensive. Like I said, you can get boxes. The Series 1 will cost a little more. Series 2 boxes I've seen closer to $30. So yeah, you know, if you go the wax pack route, all right, it'll cost you, you know, $80 or $90. I'm sure, though, you can buy a factory set for, you know, somewhere between $40 and $60 if you just want to buy the card straight up. But you know, if you're somebody who likes to hand collate sets, this is one that it looks nice. You're going to spend a little more because of that Jeter prospect card, but it could be a fun set to put together. For me, though, I just didn't have the fun of opening the packs. And it's not because of the set. It's not because of the lack of big rookies or the chase for the Jeter card. It's just because, even all these years later, it's hard to really find emotion and passion and love for baseball circa 1994. It's just hard for me. And as I'm opening up these cards, and sure, there's a Roger Clemens card, and there's a Ken Griffey Jr. card, and, you know, some interesting cards. At the same time, I'm not like, wow, you know, I should buy these. I should build this set. You know, the 93 Topps cards, I thought for a moment, well, maybe I should build this set. And then I'm like, no, Matt, stop. Don't. You know, I'll be spending my time putting together these late 70s and early 80s sets that I'm suddenly collating. But, you know, in 93, at least I had a little bit of, wow, I remember these. These were awesome. Maybe I'll put it together. But with 94, even though I'm looking through these cards and they're in decent shape and I've got some decent players, I'm just like, eh, no. I just didn't have it. I didn't feel it. Maybe it's different for you. Maybe it's different for your kids if you're introducing them to the sport now. Maybe it is a fun and affordable option for you. For me, it was definitely affordable. Fun? I don't know. And it's not because of the set. It's because of the circumstances from 1994, which unfortunately, for baseball fans, we're kind of feeling all over again in 2020. Now, despite the sadness of the 94 Topps set and the circumstances around it, I did find some interesting stories from players. And I pick four, and I actually struggled with which four. The first three were easy, but the fourth one wasn't. So I'm actually going to kind of give you 4.5, because I will mention the honorable mention, the player that I'm not going to get too detailed about, because I thought it was an interesting name from the time, and he does have an interesting story. But the player that I ultimately picked as the fourth card from our collection of 94 Topps cards actually has a far more interesting story, not for anything he did, but talking about circumstances. That was certainly the case with that player. And do you know what? Let me start with that player. The player that I chose for player 4 of 4 is Charlie Hayes. Now, who does the honorable mention go to? Real Cormier. And Real Cormier was one of those pitchers who didn't have a great start to his career, was slightly average or slightly above average, I guess you could say. But after some injuries and recoveries, he was able to be a star reliever with the Phillies back in the early 2000s. But I remember Real Cormier because it was a very unique French name. Of course, me being a hockey fan, I know a lot of French-Canadian names. And Real Cormier of Moncton, Canada, from New Brunswick. I learned this about him, and this is why I'm not completely shutting him out of the player conversation. But Real Cormier grew up, before playing baseball, he was a lumberjack. How cool is that? Real Cormier, major league pitcher who in parts over 18 years, not 18 seasons, because again, he was out for quite a bit with some shoulder injuries, but for parts of 18 years, and also as a representative of Team Canada at the World Baseball Classic and later the Summer Olympics, being the oldest player on the team, Real Cormier was a lumberjack. And there's just all sorts of Monty Python jokes there. So I had to mention that. An honorable mention, he is player 4.5 of our usual four cards that we select. But I just had to get out there. Real Cormier, lumberjack, and he's okay. All right, now, Charlie Hayes, who just beat out Real Cormier. A great picture of Charlie Hayes. You know, you have more horizontal pictures in 94, mostly for action shots. But the Topps gold Charlie Hayes that I pulled from one of these packs is a fascinating picture because it's a horizontal picture, but it is Charlie Hayes just being kind of pensive in the Colorado Rockies dugout. Or maybe he's just thinking about the mystery of life. I don't know. But whatever it is, he just doesn't look that happy. So I figured, you know, I got to dive into a little more about Charlie Hayes here, a player that I certainly knew about, and he played for a long time in the big leagues too, but didn't know exactly everything about him. Now, what's interesting about Charlie Hayes, a native of Hattiesburg, Mississippi, he actually got pretty far into the Little League World Series in 1977. He played for the South Region, a team from Hattiesburg that was in the first round of the 77 Little League World Series. And he would eventually get drafted by the San Francisco Giants in 1983, a fourth round draft selection. Took a little time to make his way up through the minor leagues, but made his debut in San Francisco on September 11th, 1988. Just had a brief cup of coffee at the end of the 88 season. And he started out with the Giants in 1989, but he got traded mid-season as he was part of a deal that sent Dennis Cook and Terry Mulholland to Philadelphia for Steve Bedrosian and a player to be named later, Rick Parker. Now, while the Giants were going on to the World Series in 1989, the Phillies were definitely rebuilding here, and Terry Mulholland would be a big part of the Phillies' 93 World Series team. But as for Charlie Hayes, he was a bit of a role player and actually played a big role in a big moment in Mulholland's career. On August 15th, 1990, Charlie Hayes muffed a throw early on in the game that Mulholland had started and pretty much killed a perfect game attempt that Mulholland was having. However, Hayes would make a nice grab off the bat of Gary Carter to give the no-hitter to Mulholland. And in fact, that great grab off a line drive off Carter's bat was the final out in the ninth inning. So he ruined the perfect game opportunity, but he did create a no-hitter for Mulholland again on August 15th, 1990. And if I remember correctly, 1990 was the year of the no-hitter. There were like six no-hitters that year. You had Dave Stewart and Denny Martinez pitching no-hitters on the same day. Dave Steeb finally getting his no-hitter in September. So that was the year where there were a whole lot of no-hitters. And then I think there was Andy Hawkins had the no-hitter that was later determined to not be a no-hitter because I think it was Rain Shorten. So Terry Mulholland getting the no-hitter and Charlie Hayes playing goat and then hero in that same no-hit bid on August 15th. Now, after his stint with the Giants, he would be traded to the New York Yankees just prior to the 1992 season, and he hit 257 that year. The Yankees were in a rebuilding mode as well. They thought that he should be a key part of it. However, mysteriously, they left Hayes exposed in the expansion draft. Rockies and Marlins picking players, and the Rockies pick Hayes as the third pick in the expansion draft. Well, the Yankees are kind of stunned, and they decide to challenge the draft selection by the Rockies by picking a fight with the Marlins. The Yankees claimed that the Marlins were not properly compensating the Yankees for lost territory in Fort Lauderdale. Now, back then, the Yankees were spring training and they had a minor league team in Lauderdale, and they would eventually move those operations to Tampa, which didn't have a team yet. So the Major League Baseball and the commissioner had to, you know, look at this situation here. And keep in mind, too, that this is shortly after the reinstatement of George Steinbrenner's control of the Yankees, and he was still not a darling of Major League Baseball. So Bud Selig rejected the claim, so Hayes became a member of the Colorado Rockies. He was the starting third baseman in their first ever game at Shea Stadium in 1993, and much like a lot of other batters in Denver, enjoyed the mile-high scenery, a career-high 25 home runs, also the rather spacious confines of Mile High Stadium, 45 doubles, 98 RBI. In 1994, he had 23 doubles and 50 RBI before that strike, and he became a free agent after the 1994 season. Re-signed with the Phillies in 1995 at a decent season that enabled him to sign a four-year contract as a free agent with the Pirates in 1996. Now, the Pirates, of course, were on the downtrend after their stretch of success in the early 90s. They started year one of an eventual, I think, 21-year rebuild. But the Pirates were heading on the way down, and midway through the 96 season, the Pirates would trade Hayes to the Yankees for a player to be named later, Chris Korn. Yes, Chris Korn, everyone's favorite Pirate. Well, obviously, going from the outhouse to the penthouse here, Charlie Hayes, he would be a member of the world champion New York Yankees in 1996. In fact, had a few big offensive and defensive plays to help the Yankees seal their first World Series championship since 1978. He would hit 258 for the Yankees in 1997. And after the season, he would be traded to the Giants for Alberto Castillo and Chris Singleton. Afterwards, Hayes kind of bouncing around a couple seasons with the Giants, split in the 2000 season with the Mets and Brewers, and eventually retired after getting released by the Houston Astros on July 9th, 2001. After his playing career, he moved into the coaching capacity, not just in minor league baseball, but also opening up his own baseball academy in Tomball, Texas. He would become a base coach for the Phillies organization just a few years ago with Lehigh Valley, later named as a coach for the Gulf Coast League Phillies. And also the Charlie Hayes family tree continues to stretch into organized baseball. A son, Tyree Hayes, would pitch for several years. He was part of the Devil Rays and later the Reds organizations, and got a few years of success in minor league ball. And also another son, Cabrian Hayes, a Pittsburgh Pirates draft selection in 2015. So again, you know, some interesting things about Real Cormier, most notably being a lumberjack and being the oldest player on Team Canada. But I just thought that the challenge by the Yankees, losing a player in the expansion draft, a player that they left exposed, and they didn't challenge the team that drafted him. They challenged the other team trying to, you know, get around the rules with the bogus territorial rights claim with the Marlins. I just thought that was very interesting. So Charlie Hayes edging out Real Cormier as our fourth player. Now, a similar story to Real Cormier is actually Rob Ducey. And Rob Ducey is just one of those fun names from 1980s and 1990s baseball. First of all, it's just kind of an interesting name, Ducey, you know? It sounds like it could be a dirty word, but it really isn't. So when you say Ducey, you kind of giggle a little bit. But also, Rob Ducey was the ultimate utility player, platoon guy, just guy in the right place in the right time most times. And Rob Ducey is actually doing rather well for himself nowadays. Now, he is a native Canadian, much like Real Cormier, born in Toronto, raised in Cambridge, Ontario. He graduated from Seminole Community College near Orlando and was signed by the Blue Jays in 1984. He would move up to the big leagues in 1987. And like I said, played all positions. He was a utility outfielder and infielder, good pinch hitter as well. He was traded from the Blue Jays at the trade deadline in 1992, along with Greg Myers, to the Angels for Mark Eichhorn. Eichhorn, just one of those extra arms in the bullpen for the Blue Jays during their first World Series run in 92. After the 92 season, he would sign with the Texas Rangers. And I remember seeing Rob Ducey at the Rangers spring training complex, and he was still walking around with a Blue Jay equipment bag, which I thought was kind of odd. So I don't know if the Rangers just never got around to giving him a bag, or that was just a sign of things to come. You know, you get a high number at spring training and you don't get your own equipment bag, it means you should probably rent your furniture. But anyways, Ducey would hang around with the Rangers for a couple of years, and in fact is featured in the Rangers uniform here on his 1994 Topps card. Couldn't find any takers after the 94 season, so he moved on to Japan, played a couple seasons with the Nippon Ham Fighters, always a great baseball name there. So you have a Ducey and a Nippon Ham Fighter. Then he would come back stateside, play for the Seattle Mariners for a couple seasons, later the Philadelphia Phillies, where he was part of a very interesting trade in baseball history. On July 26, 2000, traded by the Phillies to the Blue Jays for minor league pitcher John Sneed. And then about 2 weeks later, on August 7th, the Blue Jays traded Ducey back to the Phillies for Mickey Morandini. And of course, it is mandatory to use your Harry Callis voice when you say, Mickey Morandini. So Mickey Morandini goes to Toronto. Rob Ducey has a cup of coffee with his former team and then eventually goes back to the Phillies. He would then play with the Montreal Expos in 2001, adding another interesting footnote to his career as he became the first Canadian big leaguer to have played for both Canadian teams, the Expos and Blue Jays, and for the Canadian Olympic team, in which he played for in 2004. So he was the first of several players who would eventually fall into that club. Later, Matt Stairs, Denny Boucher, and Sean Hill would play for the Expos, Jays, and an Olympic team for Canada. Now, after his career wound down in 2001, he would eventually become a minor league hitting coach with the Expos and the Yankees, later hired by the Blue Jays as a talent scout. Was part of the purge by the Blue Jays in October of 2009. Eventually became a scout with the Tampa Bay Rays in 2011. And later joined the Phillies organization, serving as a hitting coach. Now, an interesting thing about Rob Ducey, he is also a hitting coach for the Fubon Guardians of the Chinese Professional Baseball League. So we have a Ducey coaching Fubons. And he also is a salesperson for a baseball equipment company based in the Tampa Bay area, believe it or not. I'm now trying to connect with him on LinkedIn here. He lives in Tarpon Springs with his wife and their three children. So Rob Ducey, the ultimate platoon guy, the ultimate utility guy, still keeping that utility going, selling baseball products on one side, a hitting instructor in China on the other. And certainly doing rather well for himself nowadays. Now, Dave Burba, that was another fun name, a Burba. But also, you know, Dave Burba was one of those guys, and I remember as I'm pulling this card out of the pack, I'm thinking, Dave Burba just had that one good year. What was that one year? And I couldn't quite remember. And then when I'm doing a little research on Dave Burba, I'm reminded that Dave Burba had that one good year about three times in his career. Dave Burba didn't do anything spectacular. He had quite the repertoire of pitches, though, and that's what certainly served him well in a big league career that stretched out over 15 years. Dave Burba, a native of Dayton, Ohio, while he had just a few of those decent seasons in his career, he was also a part of a couple of big trades in baseball history. The biggest would be on December 11, 1991, traded by the Mariners along with Mike Jackson and Bill Swift to San Francisco for Mike Remlinger, minor league prospect Joshua Knox, and Kevin Mitchell. Of course, Mitchell would flame out with the Mariners over the next couple of years. Well, this would give Burba the opportunity with this rebuilding Giants team, a Giants team that won over 100 games in 1993, but finished one game behind the Braves in the National League West race. And it was 93 that Burba had arguably his best season with a 10-3 record and a 4.23 earned run average. Now, he would be part of a bigger trade in July of 1995 as he's traded with Darren Lewis and Mark Portugal to the Cincinnati Reds, for Ricky Pickett, John Roper, Scott Servais, David McCarty, and Deion Sanders. This is when Sanders' baseball star was definitely falling. He was becoming more of a football star. And Burba would finish out the 1995 season. Again, you look at his combined numbers with San Francisco and Cincinnati, and you can argue that 1995 was his best record. But then you saw in 1997, he had a decent record with the Reds. He went 11-10. Earned run average wasn't impressive, but it was lower than some other seasons, a 4.73. And he suddenly became attractive to the Cleveland Indians. Even though Burba was slated to be the opening day starter for Cincinnati, the Indians were looking for a replacement for Oral Hershiser, who had left after the 1997 season. And Hershiser, of course, a big influence in the success of the Indians in 1997. So Burba gets traded for prospect Sean Casey. That's a deal that kind of worked out for both teams. And in 1998, he had a pretty solid season, 15-10. Also pretty solid in 1999 and 2000, racking up some wins. But again, his earned run average always floated in the upper fours. So that's why it's hard to really pin down when was Dave Burba's best year? Because a lot of those wins were not because Dave Burba was a great pitcher. It's because he had plenty of offense in that Indians lineup in the late 90s. Suffered some pretty big injuries in 2001 and afterwards would bounce around through several teams, playing with Cleveland, Texas, Milwaukee, and later the San Francisco Giants. After the end of his career, tried to restart his big league hopes with minor league deals with Houston, later Seattle, wasn't able to really do it, and that was pretty much it for his big league career, despite fighting for about 2 years to get back into the bigs. His career ended in September of 2004. Now, he would later become the pitching coach for the Tri-City Dust Devils, also pitching coach for the Modesto Nuts, the Lancaster Jethawks, and most recently, the Hartford Yard Goats. So Dave Burba, even though he didn't have an impressive career in terms of earned run average, certainly an impressive resume of team names, ever since then. His final numbers, 115-87, that's the win-loss record, 1,398 strikeouts, not bad. Career earned run average 4.49. So changeup, splitter, slider, halfway decent fastball. You know, he had a pretty good mix of pitches, and that's certainly what kept him going for many, many years. Last but not least, you know, this is a player I may have brought up before, but with a name like Skeeter, you just got to talk about him. William Henry Barnes, better known as Skeeter Barnes, the last card that we pulled from all of our packs. And I said, all right, we got to talk about Skeeter Barnes. A native of Cincinnati, Ohio, after playing for the University of Cincinnati, was selected by the Reds in the 16th round of the 1978 Major League Draft and was able to quickly work his way up through the Reds farm system, making his Major League debut in 1983. However, he couldn't stick around in the big leagues, and this is something that I pointed out when looking at the back of his cards. He was what you would call a 4A player. He would dominate AAA, but just could not find a regular starting role in the big leagues, just could not consistently play well in the big. So while he was with Cincinnati, he was up and down from the major leagues and minor leagues. Later would go up and down with the Montreal Expos, later the St. Louis Cardinals, again the Cincinnati Reds in 1989. So he had little cups of coffee here and there. And, you know, over a seven-year time span, he would play in just 60 big league games. So this was a guy who was just having all sorts of trouble breaking in. Well, he finally gets his big break, ironically, at the age of 34. So you talk about the oldest rookie. I mean, this is a guy who finally gets a chance with the Detroit Tigers after knocking the cover off the ball in AAA. He gets a call up in 1991, and he fit in rather well with Sparky Anderson's lineup. And that's because if you remember the 91 Tigers, first of all, they had a ton of power. You had Rob Deer, you had Cecil Fielder, you had Pete Incaviglia. Was Mickey Tettleton there? Yeah, I think Mickey Tettleton was the catcher. So you had a ton of power, but you didn't have a lot of speed, didn't have exactly deft defense. And in the cozy confines of Tiger Stadium, you've got to have a little bit of that. You can't just have power. So Skeeter Barnes, who was a pretty solid defender, pretty good contact hitter, had some speed, added a little bit of life to the Tigers' base paths, very quickly became a fan favorite and a favorite of Sparky Anderson. And if you were a favorite of Sparky in Detroit in the early 90s, you might as well have been a favorite of the Pope. I mean, that's the ultimate blessing. If Sparky liked you, then you had a job. And Skeeter Barnes would have his greatest success with the Tigers from 91 through 94. In fact, had the nickname Crash Davis, of course, a reference to Bull Durham, Kevin Costner's character there. And it's mainly because Tigers fans just loved the way that Skeeter Barnes played. Now, after having that successful stretch with the Tigers, of course, age did eventually catch up, and he was released by the team following the 1994 season. He would retire and would start his minor league coaching and managing career throughout the Devil Rays organization, later the Tigers organization, and as of late, returning back to the Rays organization as a minor league outfield and base running coordinator, a position that he has held with the Rays since 2007. Now, one other interesting thing about the name Skeeter Barnes, there is a barbecue restaurant in Nebraska, named Skeeter Barnes. I don't believe there's any association here. I don't think that there's any, you know, rights deal here. You know, it's not Skeeter Barnes' face that graces the cover of the Skeeter Barnes Steaks and Barbecue restaurant in Kearney, Nebraska. But it is this rather goofy cartoon character mosquito wearing cowboy boots. But I thought that would be interesting. You know, a name like Skeeter, you know, Skeeter Barnes, you think back to, you know, a hard luck guy who finally got his break in his mid-30s with the Detroit Tigers. And there is probably not linked, probably not inspired by the ball player, but there is a Skeeter Barnes steak and barbecue restaurant in Nebraska. So if you happen to be pulling off of Interstate 80 exit 272 and you find yourself on 2nd Street in Kearney, Nebraska, pull into the Skeeter Barnes Steak and Barbecue restaurant and tell them Large Marge sent you. Well, that'll wrap up our look back at 1994. Boy, there's a lot in that onion. A lot of stinky layers in 1994, right? Boy, I had a little bit of a psycho, spiel here, didn't I? About just the hardships of being a teenager and living the teenage life and having your favorite game, baseball, pulled away from you, having another favorite game, hockey, pulled away from you, both because of player strikes, having the baseball card industry just get so big and so unaffordable on a kid's, allowance that I backed out of that. And 1994, a lot of scars, still hard to fully atone with them. Like I said, opening up those cards, they're nice cards, got some decent players. But, the passion, some of the other packs that I opened up as a kid, I'm looking at these, I'm like, okay, these are nice, but I'll probably give them to somebody. It's just not there. It's so hard to bring it in. But maybe for you, it's fun. I do like the set. And after 26 years, finally opening a pack of 1994 Topps, I will say that even though I didn't quite have the emotional attachment to it, because there are plenty of 94 Topps packs out there. Yes, they're a little pricier than some of the other junk wax. You can thank Jeets for that. But Series 1 will cost you a little more than Series 2, but it is easy to pull the two series together. Also, there's an interesting quirk. I forgot to mention this. There is no card 379 in Series 1. And it's not because, it's like retired, like Topps would do with card number 7 for Mickey Mantle. No, it's because, Mark McLemore and Benito Santiago both ended up with card number 370. That was supposed to be McLemore's number, but somehow they got both numbered 370. So there's two 370s. There's no 379. Just an interesting little quirk there. But again, you can find boxes for relatively cheap, Series 2 closer to $30, Series 1 upwards of $50 because of the Jeter card. But if you have the thrill of just some old junk wax era, if you want to get one of those early Jeter cards, if you want to get some of the black gold cards that are in there, enjoy some of the perks of chasing early 90s Chase cards for an affordable price, it's not a bad set. It does look nice. It was a pretty solid base set in a time when base sets were getting pushed to the side and all the premium sets were being highly featured by all of the baseball card producers. So 94 Topps is a decent set, and it could be a fun little collecting thing for you to do in your quarantine. But again, for me, the passion wasn't quite there. Maybe that's just me, but I think it's not the case, because I've heard from plenty of you, you're still pretty bitter over the events in baseball and the card industry circa 1994. And like me, you still haven't completely let it go. And with the current events in baseball nowadays, it's a sour reminder of some bad days in the past. The game of baseball will be great. It'll be fine. It'll live on. Baseball cards, too. You may buy the 2021 Topps packs, and every stat line for the 2020 season will say, did not play. But, we'll push on. But a whole lot of people, Major League Baseball, Major League Baseball Players Association, a whole lot of people just are not going to care. There's just too much going on in the world right now. And your little squabbles, that's what they are in the eyes of a lot of people. Little squabbles. It'd be fun to have baseball back. It would, if you can find a safe way of putting the games on to entertain fans. But arguing over dollars and cents these days, forget about it. I don't want to hear it. I've got my own dollars and cents I got to worry about here. Including a son who wants to play baseball. You got to pay the little league fee somehow, right? All right, upcoming, we've got our look at the Topps UK Minis from 1988. That will be coming out in our next podcast on July 4th. And then, like I said, we'll be talking to Brad Blukjan a little later on in the summer about the Wax Pack book. We will also unveil the identity of that mysterious set that a lot of people hate, but there's a good reason for you to like. And I'm still on the hunt for a affordable pack of 1975 Topps. That's something we've got on the radar. And we'll see what else we pull together here on Wax Ecstatic. We'll be coming your way every other Friday as we have. And I really appreciate you listening this Friday. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. You've been listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.